Okay, y'all have heard Dave and I talk kind of nonstop about Enneagrams and our Enneagram numbers, and we have got so many requests about it over the last couple of years, and we're really excited to have an expert.
Did you say that we have a guest on this
Like,
show?
it's our first guest ever, and they actually know what they're talking about. It's not people like us who are just making it up as we go along.
Wow.
I know.
Mind blown.
So we're super excited to have Chris Huertz here today to share so much wisdom, to drop all kinds of knowledge.
Hi guys, I'm Rachel Hollis.
And I'm Dave Hollis.
And we're married.
For like 14 years.
And together for 16.
We have kids.
Four kids.
Which is like 1,000 kids.
We've also been foster parents to four kids as well.
We're running a business together.
We do a lot of
That
things.
is a lot of things.
But we feel like it's possible, we know it's possible, to have an exceptional relationship regardless of the stresses you have in your life.
That's why we decided to do a podcast together.
It's called Rise Together.
So if you want some tips and tricks on how we kind of get through all the things,
this is it.
Come on down.
Here we go.
Hey Chris, man, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Super duper great to be with y'all.
Yeah. So will you tell us, like, because I know there are people listening who are way down who know the words that we are speaking, and I know there are other people who are like, what is Enneagram? How do you even spell that? What does that mean?
Is it voodoo?
Yes. Is it voodoo? Is it witchcraft? Can you tell us about your career, how you got to this place, and then we'll kind of dive into the work that you're doing.
Sure. So the first part of my career, I spent 20 years in an international community doing humanitarian work. And as soon as I graduated from university, I moved to South India, and within a few months had helped start the first pediatric AIDS care home in those eight countries in South Asia. And so at a time in my life when I should have been at visiting my friends' new babies in hospitals, I was sitting at gravesites with the children that we had taken in many cases, children that we had named, and then children who had fallen and passed too soon. And it was an amazing time in my life, but as you can imagine, it was a profoundly painful time in my life as well. I was a young guy in my 20s, and I don't think I realized sort of the access that I had, and so ended up spending quite a bit of time with Mother Teresa the last few years of her life as well. And found her to be, of course, as you could imagine, an incredible conversation partner, an outstanding and remarkable mentor, and really somebody to try to aspire or aim to live into, I think, the responsibility of the gift of her friendship and kindness to me.
Oh my gosh.
Wait a second.
I'm sorry. We're gonna handle this like a couple of buffoons because we're both over here like shaking our what? Of all the things I thought you were going to say or start with, like what a beautiful testimony, what a beautiful like beginning into adulthood. I can't even imagine how that set you up for everything that's come after.
Yeah. Like I said, I don't think I realized sort of the access that I had. And, I probably only sat with Mother a dozen or 15 times, but every time I was with her, she'd give me something. She'd sign a little blessing or a prayer card for me, or she'd give me a cross or a prayer card. We found traction really, really quickly in that work. And the man who had founded that organization a few years into it transitioned out. And so the board of directors asked me to come back to the States and take over. The primary focus of that organization then ended up becoming involvement in the anti-trafficking movement. And so we were working with kids who had been conscripted to fight in civil wars during the Blood Diamonds conflict in Sierra Leone, as well as women and children who'd been trafficked into the commercial sex industry all over the world. And so it was an amazing run. It was an incredible 20 years of my life, and I'm still really, really grateful for it. So we were doing this work. It was, man, it was a hard run. And I'll be honest with you, like a lot of us were doing this at our own expense. And so you know this if you're a decent human being, if you're a parent, that you often attempt to take better care of someone else than yourself. And I think in the work that we were doing, it was catching up to us. Secondly, we were working with a lot of young people, and I hate to say it, but it's like a lot of folks right now sort of have this ADD vocational attention span of a degree program. And so to really have to commit to something longer than 2 or 3 years is painful. It's limiting. And sort of the long way around the head to get to the nose here. But after 20 years, I needed a change. I had spent the best and the worst of myself in this work. And we, my wife and I, about 6.5, almost 7 years ago, peeled off of that organization. And we started this little center for contemplative activism. What we're trying to do is help people who are helping people. We're trying to say, if you actually believe that building a better world should come from a centered place of rootedness, then here's some meditation, mindfulness, and contemplative practices to sort of help you along the way. And really has become, I think, sort of a real positive space for the overlay of some of the work that I do with the Enneagram to sort of come in as a support or an accompanying tool or teaching or tradition to help us on this path.
All right. That is a perfect segue into the magic question, which is, what is the Enneagram?
What is this Enneagram you speak of?
Yes. So I learned the Enneagram 20 years ago in the slums of Cambodia. I was on a rooftop cafe with a friend from New Zealand, and he asked me if I'd ever heard of this. And as he started to tell me about it, it weirded me out a good bit. And then I saw the symbol and I thought, whoa, this is like super evil, like two pentagrams having sex, and thought, there's no way this is street legal for me to learn about.
Totally.
I think it finds you right on time. And when it does, and when you come across it, man, it's like a splinter in your brain that you cannot shake. So as I was introduced to this, I was introduced to it as a teaching on the 9 archetypes of human character structure. And that's one of the ways that we can look at the Enneagram in terms of understanding what we mean, let's say, by personality, or what we mean by the ways that we distract ourselves from really getting to the truth of ourselves, our essence.
When I tell people about this and they look at me funny because they don't know what that word is, I always tell them that it's like a DISC test, or it's like Myers-Briggs. It's just another way to understand yourself. And it's been around for a really long time. Is that right? Like since like ancient Greece or something.
Well, I love the sort of conflicted, contested mythology of its origins. It may be 6,000 or 7,000 years old, with sort of rumored evidence of it in the deserts of ancient Egypt. 4,000 years ago in prehistoric Korea, the early Greek mathematicians, all the great world religions in their mystical streams within Judaism, Christianity, Islam, all sort of lay claim to it. But really, we're just working with a teaching that's about 40, 45 years old when we talk about the Enneagram of personality.
Okay.
Right? Before the personality sort of overlay here, it was a process teaching. It was this Greek Armenian man who brought it forward about 102 years ago said that it was a way of reading or translating or understanding every perfect system. That if you sat in the desert and you drew this symbol in the sand over and over and over again, you could see into it everything that could be learned, and that would render libraries useless, right? So there's some wacky stuff going on here.
Yeah.
And what we've done over the last 45 years is we've really leaned into the personality aspect of it, a way of sort of observing the sort of, let's say, shape of our tragic flaw, the way of sort of coming to terms with how we've gotten lost from our true selves or our essential nature, and the 9 ways that we try to, like I said earlier, try to be loved or get love or receive it. And so,
yeah. So I'll tell you how we came into understanding this. I had a member of our team at my company. This was a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago. She had seen it somewhere. I don't remember where. And she came into the office and she put it in Slack one day. And she said, "Hey, this is a personality test. It'll trip you guys out. Everyone should go take it." And we took it as a staff so that we could kind of understand, you know, I think we did it at lunch just like for fun. And then when we started reading it, we read our own and we were like, holy smokes. And then we read other people's and we were like, holy smokes. Like, this is so stinking accurate. And I don't think it was until a few days later that I was like, oh my gosh, Dave, you have to do this test. And that was when we realized not only could you take the test and identify your type, but then you could see how your type worked with your partner. And when I read that, like, study, so Dave is a, what are you, a 3? I'm a 3. You're a 9.
I'm a 9.
Yeah.
You're a 3. And by the way, when you came home and were like, hey, you should take this test, I saw the overlapping pentagrams and thought, this is crazy. What are you speaking of? And then, of course, I took it because it was more curiosity than it was anything else. And in reading what it said about what I am, because of answering these quick questions, it was spot on.
Yeah.
But I agree with exactly what you were about to say, which is when we saw how me as a 9 and you as a 3 interact, it really was like deciphering the ways that we could better engage in constructive conversation when we disagree, and ways that we could come around each other from a, how you need to be loved or how you need to be heard or how you need to be talked to. And it was, like I said, it was a map. It was instructive for me to think differently about how you are wired so that I could meet you where you're wired.
I think what tripped me out when I read that, like how the two personalities work together, is I felt like I was reading a diary of our relationship. Because it said, these are the things that you might struggle with as a couple, and these are the things that you will do really well as a couple. And I was like, holy crap.
Are you reading my diary?
Yeah, it was crazy. Sorry, we just got off on a super personal tangent in this. But could you walk us through the different personality types that are there so that people can kind of understand how it differentiates?
Sure. So when I learned it, I learned it through fundamental needs, actually. And if you're new to the Enneagram, first of all, this funny little word, it just comes from sort of two sort of terms in Greek. So Ennea is the Greek word for 9, and gram is the word for drawing, like a diagram. And so this is a 9-pointed diagram. And if you look at it, at the top of this circle, you see 0.9, and then sort of clockwise, it's numbered all the way around there. So there's a lot of different ways to describe the energies of each of the 9 types. And there's actually names that folks at different sort of schools or Enneagram institutes have ascribed to these. And so some of the popular ones come out of the Enneagram Institute and the narrative tradition. And what they say is that the 1 is sometimes called the reformer or the perfectionist. And this is, just very fundamentally reduced down to the need to be perfect. Folks who are dominant in type 2 are sometimes called the helper or the giver. This is the need to be needed. Folks who are dominant in type 3 are sometimes called the achiever or the performer, and this is the need to succeed.
Yes, that is me, you guys. This, like, if you read the description of this, it is bananas how much it's me. And what I tripped out about was when I first read about my type, it said that a lot of times it's children who have learned to achieve through like childhood. Like they thought as little kids that if they could just achieve things, that's how they would get love or attention or notice. And I really honestly thought that was something that only happened in my family. So I love anything in life that reminds you that you're not alone and that it's not just you who feels this way. So that was super powerful for me.
Yeah. And what you just said is exactly the point here. For all of us, like I said, I really fundamentally think that this is less about 9 types of people and more about 9 ways of how we thirst for love. And so in particular, man, the 3, there's so much compassion here, because the 3 is one of the repressed, or they repress their heart center. And, I don't really like to give these handles or these names for the types, the performer or the achiever, because it's so reductionist, because it's sort of cliche. But folks who are dominant in type 3, it's not that they have this need to succeed. It's that they have misunderstood that the source of love doesn't come from what it is that they achieve or accomplish or are recognized for.
Absolutely.
But man, somehow as a child, and these so-called childhood wounds, and I actually don't think the Enneagram's childhood wounds are legitimate wounds, but the so-called childhood wound of the 3 was a wound to the heart. It was a wound of not understanding their own access to their feeling center. And so they had to reach outside of it. And that reach, it's like when you're standing by a fire and you sort of put your palms up to the flame to feel heat, the heat that they were feeling from others' emotional centers, feeling centers, was attention, admiration, recognition. And they mistook that as love.
Yes.
When simply it's just a thinned out version of affection, and affection and love aren't really the same thing at all.
So good.
So these poor folks who are 3s, it just breaks my heart, because all the drive is really not because you cannot help but sort of live into the fecundancy of your creativity or your imagination or your curiosity. No, it's really because you just want to be loved.
Yeah.
And there's all these different ways that you go at trying to feel it, trying to experience it, trying to receive it.
All right, enough of Rachel. Number four.
Dave wants you to keep going so you can get to his stuff.
Oh, man. All right. So fours are sometimes called the individualists, the romantic, the tragic romantic. With all affection, I sometimes refer to the four as the diva. This is the need to be unique. Type five is sometimes called the observer or the investigator. I love it in Spanish. They call the five the theorist. This is the need to understand. Type six is the sometimes called the loyalist, the skeptic. This is the need to be secure. Seven is the enthusiast, the need to avoid pain. Eight is the challenger. Sometimes I say the contrarian. This is the need to be against. And then nine, folks who are dominant in type nine are sometimes called the mediator, the peacemaker, the arbitrator. This is simply the need to avoid.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
And that's a little bit of a bummer for the nine, because I think it doesn't get to the complexities of what's really going on inside the head and the heart of folks who are dominant in type nine, which is the world will be okay. And I can actually navigate its okayness. I'm really good at sort of mending it and fixing it. The thing is I just don't want to have to look inside and mend all the fractured bits of my own inner landscape. And so all of us are doing this. We're creating these proxy battles outside of our hearts, our heads, our sense of selves. So the nine does this as a way of distracting themselves from that inward gaze.
So good.
Man,
so,
I feel like we're like at a psychic, and honestly, I'm like, oh, like that's so real, Dave. That is so real.
But here's the question that I have in real time. Sorry, this is not the point of this podcast, but since we're in therapy for me now, I want to ask this question. Like, we took this test at the beginning of a journey that we're in the middle of, transition-wise, where I clung to security. I was very much a don't talk about it, don't deal with it. I was clinging to maintaining a status quo at the expense of fulfillment, and have since quit my job, moved my family, gone into business with my wife, become vulnerable in crazy ways on the internet that I would not have expected, in part because of having come to some realization through work in a whole host of self-help kind of spaces that said, you're believing a bunch of lies. The real truth will actually allow you to have a deeper sense of satisfaction and fulfillment. If I were to take an Enneagram test today, will my number change?
Oh, good question.
Right? Like seasons of life change, do what you identify as an from an Enneagram perspective change?
Yeah. Well, I think that in general, the consensus, especially in sort of the professional community, would be that you're probably born your type and you're probably going to die your type. Now, it's not fatalistic. I think actually what this says, and I think what it says, if you believe this, is that you're actually here for a reason, that you are born to bring a gift forward, and that we need you to reconnect with that gift. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for the nine, that's really love. That's the holy idea. The unobstructed view of reality that the nine brings is what we need to learn about love. And that's the gift. That's the social gift, but that's really the sort of existential and spiritual gift. And then when the nine aligns with that love, what's actually sort of invigorated within the soul of the nine is right action. And so when you see love in action, this is really what we see as the sort of the need for nines to be the luminaries that they are. So if you're born your type, I think you're actually born to bring something forward into the world that's missing, and only you can bring the sort of flavor or accent to that gift.
I like that. And I'm realizing in real time, almost like when you get a 360 at work, you turn immediately to the back page to see the critical feedback and not spend any time necessarily on the positives. Each of these numbers, each of these types, each of these personalities, they have qualities that you might associate as being really good things. They also have qualities that you might associate as being not as good things. I found myself in real time as we're talking, trying to like, not actively, but actually I was being a little bit defensive of some of the not so ideal qualities of the nine to see if I could change into something else, which is more telling maybe in my need to continue to go to therapy, but also maybe even just misinterpreting a little bit of like how to read some of what's in this when, from a tool standpoint.
Yeah. So I don't want to sort of do this to you, but like, it's such a nine posture to take in terms of wanting to be so understanding of all the other types and maybe even the possibility of merging into those other types. Yes. And in fact, folks who are nines are the ones who miss a type most frequently because they're so understanding and can be so accommodating to another perspective.
You know what's funny about my number?
Best friends, Chris. I mean, what in the world?
What's funny about my number? Like you're like, maybe I'm something else. I'm like, heck yes, I'm a three. Like, yeah, I am.
Well, actually, the three is the other type that will often mistype as well. For a very different reason, right? The nines can mistype because they're so understanding and they can understand everybody else at sometimes the expense of themselves. The three will sometimes mistype because, you know, the three is incredible at playing roles. And this is part of the social gift of the three. It's they sort of look into the community, into the team, into the relationship that's most meaningful to them. And they see what's missing. And it's on the subconscious level. They volunteer themselves. They say, hey, I'll fill that space. I'll actually sort of take on another role and I'll sort of give myself for the collective good so that we can move this forward together. And the three will do that with, it's almost like they've learned a foreign language without an accent. They'll do that so well that they often believe then that they've become that proxy role, that additional sort of contributor that they've volunteered themselves
that
to be.
That explains the first, like basically all of my 20s. You just described all of my 20s.
So here we are 25 minutes into this conversation, and there may still be people that are like, how do I know what my number is? Like, is there a set of tools or a resource that you send people to traditionally to get them
probably
to do?
His book?
Well, he's obviously
Chris has a great book. Yeah, Chris tell us about your book.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. I did write a little book on this called The Sacred Enneagram. And the punchline of that book was, once you know your type, what do you do with it? How do you actually align contemplative practice and mindfulness intentions with your type so that, let's say this, that the nine Enneagram types are less about nine types of people, more about nine paths to God or more about nine paths to your true self, right?
Before we get into how understanding how your type and someone else that you are in relationships with type meshes well, or how you can, because of knowing these things, have a stronger relationship. Chris, can you explain how you even understand what your type is in the first place?
Yeah. So there's so many ways to sort of bring your type forward. And I'll say this first, just as sort of a caution, that it really is sort of a kind of sacred pilgrimage. It's really yours to bring forward. So we all have a tendency, once we learn this teaching, to want to type other people. And that's really a party foul. It really isn't our business to put type on someone else. So work with yourself. And work with yourself. And that's, I think, some of the good advice here. But I think when you are ready for this and you want to find your type, there's plenty of tests that you can take online, and some of those are free. The Enneagram Institute has, I think, the best test out there, and that's the RETI. That's R-H-E-T-I, and that might be $10 or $12, but it's actually worth it. They send you some really good material to help you sort of translate, let's say, the tea leaves of what all this means. Now, I know that there are folks who actually and fundamentally think that the test is the worst way to bring your type forward, because your type isn't the collections of foibles and caricatures and idiosyncrasies about you. Your type really is the gift of your essence. It's behind the masks that you wear. And I think that's what we mean by personality. So there's other ways of doing this, which is through typing process interviews, through panel works, or meeting with somebody who's trained and sort of helping with inquiry, you bring type forward. My sense is this: however you can get to it, allow it to be a gentle process, and really, really, really allow it to be compassionate. Because what happens for a lot of us when we see our type the very first time is it feels like somebody's just pressed on the stress fracture in our soul, and it can be humiliating for our egos when it shouldn't be. And so be kind with yourself, find a little bit of sense of humor with this, and then learn to self-observe. And if I don't say this 100 times, I haven't said enough, because if we can't self-observe, then we can't self-correct. And if we can't self-correct, then of course we're not bringing the best of ourselves into our relationship.
That's great. All right. So we have identified who we are by whatever means we have gone through that process. How then does knowing what we know help us in relationship with others?
Right. So, you know, I was saying earlier, I'd been part of this international humanitarian group for 20 years. And man, I wish I had the fluency then that I have now around the Enneagram. Because what I was unable to do in those 20 years was really be truthful about myself, right? And when I'm not truthful with myself, then I can't be truthful with the people I love. And it was harming relationships. I sometimes say that the Enneagram, and especially when we're talking about the Enneagram of personality, is our ego set of coping addictions that we've wrapped up around these childhood wounds so that we don't have to tell ourselves the truth about who we really are. And that's devastating to have to be honest, because what that does is it begins to dismantle the sort of scaffolding we built out around the projection of our ego mythology. And if I'm not being truthful with you in a relationship, then what really is the substance or the foundation for that relationship?
Out of curiosity, this is, I don't even know if this is a taboo thing to ask an Enneagram expert, but what is your number?
So
is that inappropriate?
No, I'm fine. I think my type is actually always showing, so it's not surprising for people who know me. I'm Enneagram type 8.
Yeah,
and what always happens when I'm like, yeah, I'm an 8, is somebody will say, oh yeah, I used to work with an unhealthy 8. And it's like, that's the sort of given response. And I'm like, oh, they probably weren't an unhealthy 8. You probably just weren't enough of yourself. Ooh. And so they pushed on that.
That's interesting.
It's a bummer because the 8 gets beat up a lot in sort of the Enneagram side chatter, but that's because the 8 beats up on people quite a bit.
But I thought I had always heard, you know, with any of these numbers that there's a healthy version and an unhealthy version of both of these things. Like 8s can be, I thought I have always heard that 8s can be tyrannical, and they can also be world changers. They can also be people that, you know, I thought, I'm going to say this stuff like I'm an expert and I'm not, and you can correct me, but I had always heard that like Martin Luther King Jr. was an 8 and Mother Teresa was an 8, like that they were leaders who changed the world.
Yeah, I actually believe that. I believe that Mother was an 8. And I know for a long, long time, people had assumed that she was a 2, right? Mm-hmm. This need to be needed, this helping, compassionate figure. But 8s and 2s are connected with one of those crisscrossing lines inside the circle. And what those lines show us is where we can reach when we're centered, and where we reach when we're stressed. And man, I really believe it. I really believe as a centered, rooted 8, when she would reach across that circle and grab that compassionate energy of type 2, that's really when you saw her at her best. That's why we still admire her today. Right.
So for a couple like us, because I think, you know, we've read the information on how we both kind of work together. So if you're right now, you're canceling a 3 and a 9, what could you tell us about what would be great possibly about our relationship and where there might be pitfalls? Because I think what was really helpful for me was to read what the pitfalls were, because I don't know that I ever would have admitted those things to myself. And when I saw them in print, I was like, that's so right. Like, I would do that.
I actually too, it was like the, like a identifying what a trigger could be for her was just even the awareness of that trigger had me think differently about how I'd engage in any kind of conversation, good or otherwise.
So this will be a lot of fun. So actually I would say first off, like if I was sort of sitting with a couple that were 3 and 9, you know, the first thing I think I would immediately want to point out is this is a really good pairing, right? The 3, the 6, and the 9. This is the triangle in the middle of the circle of the Enneagram. And they call the 3s, the 6s, and the 9s pragmatists. These are folks that are really practical. They stick with things that work. And man, they somehow seem to find their way to each other pretty frequently in relationships. And so you at least have a good foundation for understanding each other. And I imagine you probably work really well together.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
And so you have that going for you. And I think like in all things, we want to build off our successes, right? And so there's you have a common ground for your shared footing. Now, because 3 is in the heart center, and because 9 is in the body center, this is one of the first areas where you may experience some divergence.
Wait, I have to ask you before you move on from this, just to unpack that a little bit. What is the difference between heart center and body center in this sense?
Yeah. Well, all right. So I think one of the easiest ways to find yourself in the Enneagram is to start with the 3 intelligent centers, right? And so types 8, 9, and 1 are in the body center. Types 2, 3, and 4 are in the heart center. And then types 5, 6, and 7 are in the head center. And when we talk about these intelligent centers, the body, the heart, and the head, what we're talking about is primarily our primary way of perceiving reality, our primary way of perceiving the world. And so do you do that through your gut, through your instincts? Do you do that through your heart or through your feelings? Or do you do that through your head and through your thoughts? And when you know that about yourself, if you're a gut person, a heart person, a head person, actually what you really get to do is to begin to learn how to trust your own pathways for discernment, right? These are natural spaces to learn how to make good decisions about what's good, true, and beautiful for us, right? So you two are this is great. You know, that one of you is in your body and one of you is in your heart. Simultaneously, and let's come back to the 3, the 6, and the 9, because these are the revolutionary types. These are the anchor points of the Enneagram. The 3s, the 6s, and the 9s are the most disconnected from their center. So actually the 3 is the most disconnected from their heart center, which means part of your inner work is learning to trust your heart again and really letting yourself be love for what love feels like, not what you have to do to achieve it or earn
100%.
It. 100%. Yeah. For Dave there in the body center, the 9 is the most disconnected from their own body. So really the inner work for the 9 is to engage that sense of embodiment. And this might not actually sound like great advice, but what I usually tell folks who are dominant in type 9 is you will learn that, I think, most efficiently and effectively through actually aligning yourself with what upsets you, where you begin to start to feel your frustration and your anger. Because for those of us in our bodies, 8s, 9s, and 1s, our most accessible emotion is a form of anger. But for 9s, they've repressed that anger. They've never given themselves permission to really feel it.
Sorry.
And so they hide it from themselves.
That's so good.
So, you know, so this is the bummer, man. So for 9s, it's like hiding that anger from yourself is part of the residue of this so-called childhood wound of, hey, I'm going to be as understanding as I possibly can be. In fact, I'm going to be more understanding than I should be by minimizing my own needs. I'm going to take what's important to me. I'm going to put it in my back pocket. I'm not going to set it down and walk away from it. I'm going to keep it close, but I'm going to hide it from myself.
Dave is literally crying right now.
I'm not crying tears, but like I can't see through my eyes. So good work.
Faith.
Good work, Chris.
Oh my gosh, that's so good. Yes, sorry.
So I'm not saying this, Dave, about you. I'm just saying in general for folks who are nine.
We're making progress here.
So what nines also have done is they've taken actually this inner sense of permission to feel their anger, and they've also hidden that from themselves. And so to reconnect with your anger is actually where you begin to practice discernment. And this is a bummer for nines who finally let themselves feel a little bit of that anger. It's clumsy. They're not good at it. They feel really bad when it comes out, and then they think they have to apologize for it. But it's like, no, like let it be a wave that you surf towards truth and surf towards realigning with what it was that you hid.
So good. I mean,
you didn't give yourself.
I'm just coming off of a stage where I'm talking about putting on headphones and going on a long run, or using alcohol to numb the feelings of this weird transition from my 30s to my 40s. And it's just like, it's so resonant in every single thing that you're saying, because feelings like bigger than normal feelings were coming up in this big existential, why am I here? And what's my purpose? And am I living fully into God's potential that he's given to me? And the answers that were coming back weren't ones that I liked. And instead of dealing with it, I was doing everything I could in a super unhealthy way to have to not deal. So, so real, man.
Yeah. This is an incredible sort of phase of life transition where, and look, this is for all of us, we're always in a phase of life transition, whether we recognize it or not, but it's the sort of becoming more truthful. So look, if you're a nine out there or Dave, as a body type person, but specifically as a nine, sort of, you know, disconnected from that body to sort of connect with that, that frustration is sort of the yellow brick road to truth. Now, if you're a three, or if you're in the heart center, that most accessible emotion is a form of guilt or shame. And for the three in particular, that shame is the sort of shame of, look, I'm a source of authenticity. I'm a source of truthfulness in the world, right? The holy idea of the three, the unobjected, unobstructed view of reality is hope and hopefulness. But man, sometimes for a three to get the rest of us on board with hope, you have to sort of curve the corners. You have to come around the edges, maybe not as directly as some of the others of us might. And so that may feel like a form of an exaggeration, let's say, or there may be something that's not entirely authentic or truthful about it. And so that triggers this shame in the three, who's like, hey, if I'm a source of authenticity, if I'm a source of truth, then why can't I be as true to my own truth as I would idealize it to be?
Absolutely.
And so what happens here is this anger and this guilt collide. And so, you know, a nine and a three coming together would sometimes look like this. The nine is going to repress or suppress part of themselves to pander to those feelings of guilt or shame that they're intuitively going to pick up on in a three. In fact, they may pick up on it when a three's not even picking up on it for themselves. And so there's sort of an untangling of truths and exaggerations here between, I think, nines and threes that really can get complicated. Secondly, when I would look at a nine and three together, I would look at your fundamental social needs. And these social needs are also your needs in your intimate relationships. And when your intelligence centers, the head, the heart, and the body are misaligned, it can lead to some real frustration in relationships. So for those of us in our bodies, eights, nines, and ones, this fundamental social need is for autonomy. For those of us in our hearts, twos, threes, and fours, this is for connection. And for folks in their heads, five, six, and sevens, it's for security. What's tricky is if you're a three and you really do need and long for that connection as one of the sort of bonders of intimacy and relationships, but you're paired with a nine who needs autonomy, then you're going to really misunderstand each other. And so the misunderstanding is this: if you're a nine, your need for autonomy to own your sense of self is actually what's going to allow you to give yourself back to someone else. And for three, that's how they're going to connect. But for nine, it also has to be an intentional sort of accessing your heart center, which isn't your dominant center, so that that connection doesn't lead to sort of, I think, unhelpful comparisons, which then for threes can lead to some real dissatisfaction in relationships.
Absolutely. Okay, so conflict resolution. That's what we're going to talk about, or conflict avoidance, or how do you describe this?
Sure. So our Enneagram type actually shows us the love offering that we bring to de-escalate conflict, to sort of bring things down when the stakes get really high, when the conversations get really critical or crucial. This is also subconscious. We don't know that we're doing it. And so there's three love offerings that the Enneagram sort of gives us. And the first one, and this is folks who are twos, sevens, and nines, is the gift of reframing, right? This is the positive outlook conflict avoidance style. So something is triggered when somebody gets upset, twos, sevens, and nines suddenly sort of just go to, hey, it's not that bad, or hey, it could be worse, or hey, let's look on the bright side. And they're not exaggerating, and they're not diminishing the intensity of a scenario. They're just saying, hey, it doesn't have to get as bad as I think it might. So let's cut that off. And that's the gift that they bring.
That's so, I mean, by the way, that's 100% Dave Hollis. Because I will get upset about basically anything. And he's like, it's not that bad. They didn't mean, I know that they cut off your left arm, but they did not mean to. You have a right arm. You're fine.
Yes. And that positive outlook is really a gift. I mean, it really, truly is. The problem is, unless we're a two, a seven, or a nine, we generally aren't prepared to receive the gift. So what we do is we counter with our style. So for those of us that are fours, sixes, and eights, it's emotional intensity. It's reactivity. It's just discharging our frustration or anger, and it's getting it off our chest. And look, if you're not a four, six, or eight, that for sure does not feel like conflict avoidance. In fact, that feels like you're trying to provoke conflict. But it's like, if I can just get it off my chest, I'm done with it. I've set it down. I've moved on from it. Now, that love offering, let's say, is a really hard one to receive. And so that often leads to misunderstanding. This leads us with, of course, the ones, the threes, and the fives. And the love offering, the ones, the threes, and the fives bring to de-escalate conflict is objective understanding, right? It's just rational competency. It's clear-headed thinking. So when something really intense is about to happen, about to pop, when you're on the precipice of that old fight that you've had many, 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 many times, you know, the ones, the threes, and the fives are going to stop and are just going to say, hey, let's figure this out. Let's get to the bottom of this. Why do we keep coming back here? And it can almost be a disembodied, almost non-emotional experience.
Yeah, we're both sitting here nodding our heads. I totally agree.
What happens is when we don't receive the gift that somebody is bringing us, it actually leads to conflict. This is really why the fight is often never about the fight. It's simply because we're not receiving a gift from each other. And on a subconscious level, there is some pain, or that does hurt. When I talk about this, I try to sort of illustrate it with my wife, who's a two, and myself, who's an eight, right? And so Felina, positive outlook, myself, emotional reactivity, right? Intensity. When we fight, it sometimes goes like this. We jump in the car, driving from our little townhouse down to the center. It's, you know, it's a mile and a half. It's 14 stoplights. My sweet puppy Basil sitting on Felina's lap, and somebody cuts me off. All right. So review really quick. I'm a body type, right? Eights, nines, and ones. Our most accessible emotion is frustration or anger. So somebody cuts me off and I smash the horn and I'm like, that son of a gun. That's my conflict avoidance style. I'm discharging my anger so that I don't have to sort of carry it forward into the rest of my day. Sweet Felina, sitting beside me, type two, positive outlook, realizes, hey, Chris is getting upset, so let me help him. She brings the positive outlook, the reframing style. And she says, oh, I don't think he saw you. And suddenly, something that shouldn't actually be a fight just triggers an old fight, because I don't think she understands the intensity of the situation. So I have to come back even firmer and say, oh no, he saw us. In fact, he's trying to kill my dog. Yes. And Paulina's like, the dog's okay. I'm okay. I don't think he would have cut you off if he had seen the dog. Again, reframing this. And now, like, I'm really upset. She's trying to help me. And suddenly we're fighting about something that's not a fight.
This conversation is so much more powerful if you understand that Chris's Instagram is literally half dog pictures. It's so much more understandable if you would just glance at his Instagram and understand how much he loves this dog.
I do love my dog. So when somebody's trying to kill my dog, I got to teach him a lesson. And what ends up happening is I'm so furious that whoever cut me off, I'm frustrated because Felina doesn't understand how terrible of a person that driver was. Felina's like, poor Chris doesn't need to be upset about this. We're all okay. That we walk into our office here and poor Betty, who works with us, sort of has to pick up on the energy. And this is the bummer of being in relationship. We stick with things that don't work. And so if my conflict avoidance style actually lands me in a fight, I think on a subconscious level that it's going to get me out of the fight. And what you learn in the Enneagram is that it's always the third style that's the reconciling style.
Ooh.
So if I'm emotional intensity and Felina's positive outlook, then what we have to do to get out of the fight is to appeal to objective understanding, which then sounds like, all right, Chris, you probably were driving too fast. And Felina, the dog, probably shouldn't be sitting on your lap in the front seat. And if we could sort of just see it as it is, then we can back out of it.
Man, you're tripping me out right now. You're tripping me out because my dad is I'm not looking at it. I think he's a six. What's the loyalist?
The six, yep.
Okay, so I, you know, have spent 35 years trying to work through the relationship with my dad. And I'm thinking of times because he is absolutely what you said. I've always described him as a tea kettle. Like, he has to scream, but as soon as he screams, he's fine. And I am like super wounded because that's not how I process anything. But I'm thinking of the times when our relationship, when we have successfully navigated around hard things, it has been because honestly, I've spent like months like praying and trying to figure out the right way to have a conversation with him. And I bring it to him in a super like, whatever the one you just said, like you've got to like map around it. I don't know. You're just tripping me out because this isn't just about how we manage relationships with our partners. It's also the intimate relationships we have with our family members.
Yes. And I think when you can understand the harmonics and you can really understand how to work with this, it changes everything. I mean, it shows you, like I said, how frequently the fight is never, ever about a fight. And in fact, what's so sad, and I think for a lot of us in relationships, when we feel the most misunderstood, and it's like, why is this driving us apart? It's because we're not learning to receive what the other tries to give, you know?
So, what I think is interesting too is it doesn't mean that you're not going to slam on the horn when the guy cuts you off next week. But having the self-awareness of who you are and who your partner is maybe keeps the energy that you're walking into the office with from being as toxic as it would have been if it weren't for the fact that you understand how you have to now depend on that third.
Well, and if you both know how you're going to pull yourselves out of that situation, you can commit to that together.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, and hey, this is what we're going to do every time.
And it also sort of helps you learn not to enable the sort of unbecoming patterns or habits of the other.
Yeah.
And so what we have to do when we learn these conflict avoidance styles, like I said, we can't enable each other to be ridiculous. So if I'm driving sporadically and I smash on the horn, and that's a so-called love offering to de-escalate my inner conflict, then Felina, in sort of navigating the intricacies of relationship, what she does is she has to receive that and says something like, yeah, what a jerk. And then it's like, I just drop right back into the same conversation we were having a split second ago without even sort of blinking.
That's
now,
so good.
She's not enabling me to be an idiot. And so what she's doing is she's putting her arm around me saying, yeah, what a jerk. But, and then whatever she says next, I can hear, which might be, you need to slow down.
Yeah. You're
being too aggressive on the road. And so when you learn the sort of dance here, you really learn how to move with and forward together. So, you know, if you're talking about a three and a nine, a positive outlook nine, reframing conflict, a three trying to be really sort of objective about it, it sounds ridiculous, but probably your reconciling style is going to be an emotional intensity approach to being honest about how you've really hurt each other on a deep level. And and the real pain that maybe either of you are not allowing yourself to feel. Because when you're honest about the depths of that pain, then you can actually sort of contend with it. And so for threes and nines, it's really learning to have the fight, not the outburst.
Oh, we just looked at each other.
The very best stuff that has come out of our relationship is when, despite every impulse to the contrary, we have held hands or pushed each other into the muck. We've waded into it and sat in that discomfort, and the product that came out of really being in it has been overwhelmingly great. It's just so counter to like our basic natural instinct.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're still skeptical as a listener of this podcast of what this could or could not be, we met Chris 8 seconds before we started recording.
Yeah.
And Chris has just read the diary of our relationship and about us individually. And it's not, you know, like mystic. It's truly, I think, just an understanding of how every one of us individually is created uniquely and lives inside of these different spaces. And by understanding how the interplay between spaces shows up, he can speak to how Ray and I in every day need to think, or at least be considerate of how we're each wired to more fully appreciate each other and have a richer, fuller relationship. And that's possible for you too.
I think what's so interesting is you're saying it so much more eloquently and beautifully than like the little report or whatever that we read. The way that it described it at the time, like potential, pitfalls or whatever of this pairing were, I need his attention. I need it. Like, feel like I need it. And that can come across to him. Like, and he's so, so gracious and so giving and so supportive because he's my person. He's like the only one whose attention that I need. But if I don't get it, then it hurts my feelings. But he then simultaneously can have times where he's like, how much more attention can I possibly give you? Like, I remember reading that part of this pairing and I was like, oh crap, that's so right. That really is what it is. He is like tired, or he needs some time by himself or whatever. And I'm like, well, you don't love me.
Or it's opening day of NFL football and I've decided that I want to watch games. And you've asked me if I would go to a coffee shop. And when I said no, because of NFL day
like
starting, we didn't talk for 2 days.
I forgot about that.
I didn't.
Okay, great.
Well, so let's look at this. If you don't mind, there's a couple other ways we can also look at nines and threes in relationships. This might also help nines and threes who are out there listening, because honestly, it is a pretty common pairing. Like I said, because it works. It functions really well when people are compassionate with themselves and truthful with each other. Now, Karen Horney was a neo-Freudian psychologist, and she died in the 50s, actually. But she wrote about, well, she took Carl Jung's 8 archetypes of personality, and she wrote about them in terms of how they go about getting their needs in relationships met. And one of the great grandfathers of the modern Enneagram, Claudio Naranjo, sort of took this and tricked it out and sort of showed us the different methods or approaches, or sometimes it's called stances, that we use to see our needs met. And so for fours, fives, and nines, that is a moving away from people, right? These are sometimes perceived as more isolated types of folks. And actually how nines get what they want, they actually withdraw. And so if you're not a nine, that doesn't actually look like a way of getting anything. In fact, it looks like a way of resigning or actually distancing from relationships. So again, I'd say if a three and a nine are together, it's like when nines withdraw, they're actually doing this to bring themselves back into relationship, right? Fours withdraw because they want to be seen. Fives withdraw because they want to be secure. Nines withdraw to fortify that inner strength, right? That need for autonomy. And man, if you don't understand it, it looks like a form of rejection. It can come across as sort of low-key betrayal or smugness. And it never, well, sometimes it might be. But in general, it never really is.
But that's so good. Just now, if you can appreciate that, then when you see it, again, it's like that triggers idea. Like if you see that and your trigger would normally be to be resentful of it or feel hurt by it, and you just realize, oh no, I'm sorry, it's the way you're wired and I understand why you do it. The heart you have for, empathy you have for me as a nine would just be fundamentally different, change the way that we engage.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it just helps. I mean, it just helps, first of all, knowing this about yourself, like, all right, here I go again. I'm detaching, I'm withdrawing, I'm stepping back. And why am I doing that? Well, if it's actually so that I can bring myself forward, fabulous. Take care of yourself, do what you need. Now, sometimes the nine opts out. Sometimes the nine checks out. And sometimes the nine can really sort of get into this sort of like autopilot mode. And that's not really
healthy,
ideal for bringing yourself back into relationship. But you have to learn to watch that as well, because the sort of muscle memory of opting out isn't a showing up. It isn't an embracing and engaging the best of yourself so that you can bring
it forward. What did you call them? Like the coping or the avoidance? What is that for a three?
So this sort of social style or this sort of approach to getting your needs met for the three, they mirror up with sevens and eights. So sevens, eights, and threes, they move against people. Now, it's a little bit of a bummer to say moving against people, especially for threes, because threes are subtle. Threes are low-key. Like the funny thing about threes, quietly competitive, and they would never want us to know that, but there's a real strong driver in the three. And the threes never want that to be exposed. So the sort of moving against people of the three is really the subtle ways that the three demands that they're seeing, that they demand the connections that they want. It doesn't come across as demanding. In fact, it's almost like a Jedi mind trick where they make us think we're giving them something that they've quietly orchestrated. And so it's a sort of side hustle here. And nines in particular are really attuned to it. And so they don't respond well to it. So, you know, again, if we're like, hey, how are nines and threes going to work this out? It's like when the nine withdraws, give them a second. They're going to show up when the three sort of comes at you from the side to get what they want. Listen to it, respond to it, and move into it, but move into it as a way of making deeper connections around truthfulness and beauty and love. Because if you don't, the three will act out, and the three will become more demanding, and the subtlety will become a little bit more aggressive. And it may come across as too much for some.
So good. Such good information today, Chris. Oh my gosh. Thank you. This might be the longest interview we've ever done, even on my podcast, because we just couldn't stop talking to you. We are so stinking grateful for your time and your wisdom and just literally barely scratching the surface of this topic. So if you want to find out more about Chris, tell everybody where they can find you on social, on the internet. Where did they get your book? Give us all that juicy detail.
Sure. So you can learn more about our work at gravitycenter.com. We host retreats, workshops, and we really try to sort of demystify mysticism to make this really easy and accessible and practical for people with busy lives. If you go to sacredenneagram.org, you can always find the hit list of the workshops that we're doing. And we do these literally all over the world, from Cambodia and South Africa and Toronto to little places like Nebraska and, you know, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And then you can chase us down at Chris Hewerts on Twitter, Instagram. But if, you know, really, if there's ever anything that we can do for any of the folks in your community, just hit us up or holler our way. And
yeah, thank you so much. I feel like I want to go write in a journal or something about all the stuff that we found today. We're definitely going to be talking it through over the weekend. Really, really good stuff.
Thank you, Chris. We appreciate you and appreciate your time.
Hey guys, if you liked today's episode, I hope that you will subscribe to the Rise Together podcast. You will get a notification every single time we have a new episode comes out, which is every Thursday.
And take a picture, a screenshot, put it up on Instagram, tag Rise Together podcast, put it out to all of
the humans that you know. Tag us so we can see and we can say thank you.
Man, let everyone know.
And if you don't like it, don't tell anyone.
Yeah, just keep that to yourself, sister.
Please.